Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
It's another edition of Mind Food Radio. Care Australia's coming on the show today, Michael.
They sure are, and a guy who does endurance cycling.
Angus Stewart, he's got some great tips today on watering plants during summer.
And we've also got Tom Rutledge. He was actually the very first person to get voted off MasterChef.
Of course, and our friend who loves talking about polarity and balancing our health out.
Oh yes, Therese Mudgeway. We love Therese on the show.
She'll be joining us as well, right here on Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Now, Michael, you've been walking around the studio today saying, hello, fresh. And everyone wants to know what that's all about.
Well, do you remember this guy, Tom Rutledge? He actually was on MasterChef. He was the first guy to go, but he was a good guy. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember Tom now.
I sort of wish he had hung around because it would have been quite interesting to see what he had done.
He could always go back on another one.
Oh,
doesn't need to. He's doing something great now.
Exactly. I'd like to welcome to the show Tom today. Hi, Tom.
G'day, guys. How you doing?
Good. Now, you have created a company called HelloFresh. What's all that about?
That's right. HelloFresh is a grocery delivery company. What we do is we write recipes and then put everything you need for those recipes in a box and deliver it to customers' doorsteps on a Monday.
And where do all the ingredients come from? So you do all the sourcing yourself? You don't have to worry about it as the person buying it?
Exactly. So there's sort of two sides to it. One, we take a load off on the menu planning side and we offer constant inspiration so you're not either eating spaghetti bolognese 5 nights a week or constantly wondering what you're going to cook. And the other side of it is we do all the legwork and we don't just go to the supermarket and fill your bags for you. We go to our suppliers all around Sydney and make sure we're getting good produce. Our fruit guys spend a lot of time out at Flemington markets. Our beef producers own their own cattle up in Armidale, and we come get stuff straight out of the Sydney fish market. So it's all really good stuff and really interesting recipes.
Now, you've got a great new one for Christmas, haven't you? What can we expect in the Christmas boxes?
Yeah, well, the Christmas box, that's taking to the next level. So HelloFresh is about being, I guess, fuss-free with a bit of an emphasis on health and staying in shape during the week. But obviously, you've got to depart from that at least once a year, and that's Christmas time. So we've gone all out this Christmas. We're putting a ham in the box with some prawns, some beautiful salads, but then with a plum pudding and a gourmet cheese selection as well. And the idea behind that is people who don't have time or they just don't rate going to the shops at this awful time of year, or if they're maybe doing their first Christmas and they're a bit nervous about what to put on the table, we've done everything from woe to go. Pretty much the only thing we don't do is turn up and take out the garbage for you, but there's everything you need for a Christmas lunch or dinner, depending on what you do.
Now, this is a very cool idea, and I guess, you know, in retail at the moment, it's changing so much. We are shopping online more. We are buying our groceries online, and this is the next step in that you're giving us a recipe and everything there to make it. Where do you get all your inspiration from?
I think I draw a lot of inspiration from many of the places that I think we all do. I watch a lot of cooking shows on TVs. I compulsively buy cookbooks. I look at cooking magazines, the list outs in the newspapers. I go out to dinner a lot. You know, there's just inspiration comes from all sorts of different areas. And then the challenge for us is to turn that into recipes and not just an item on a plate, but a whole meal, and to make sure that the produce that we want to use is available and good quality.
And how many items do you have? Like, how many boxes and stuff can you choose from?
So we've got a 3-meal-a-week box or a 5-meal-a-week box. And that's for 2 people, 4 people or 6 people. And we also have a vegetarian box as well.
Oh, okay.
And there's no choice in the meals. We pack a standard product every week and then the people who are our customers just receive that. And it's a bit of a mystery box when it arrives on the doorstep. And a lot of people, they're a bit unsure about that when they start. They're, you know, the control freaks amongst us. And I think I'd probably count myself in this category. I wasn't too sure about how people would react, but it's one of the most overwhelmingly positive bits of feedback we get is people are cooking these things that they would never have chosen, they didn't think were possible, things that, you know, they read in a Good Living or a Delicious magazine.
Well, look, thanks a lot. I think it's a fantastic idea. And if you're time poor, particularly at this time of the year with Christmas, head to HelloFresh because they take all that fuss out of it. So it's hellofresh.com.au/Christmas. Thanks a lot for being on the show today, Tom.
Thanks very much for having me, guys. Good to talk.
Cheers.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Tamar Spads joins us on the radio now, and she's looking after a project called 1 Billion Rising. Tamar, welcome to the show. What is 1 Billion Rising all about?
Well, 1 Billion Rising is the brainchild of Eve Ensler, who's the playwright and women's activist who produced Vagina Monologues a number of years ago. And for the last 10 or so years, she's been running V-Day, which is a reclamation of Valentine's Day, where she's been asking women and men around the globe to put on productions of the Vagina Monologues to raise awareness and money for domestic violence shelters. For 2013, her vision is to have women and men across the globe dancing their protest around violence and exploitation of women. So she's trying to bring some joy and visibility to the issues surrounding domestic violence and broader societal exploitation of women.
Now, it's a topic we hear a lot mentioned on radio and TV, but how bad is it out there?
Well, her stats suggest that one in three women will be the victim of either violence or exploitation in their lifetime, which is really quite shocking when you think about the magnitude of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that in some countries, women are just so much more likely to be victimized as sort of victims of war. And even in Australia, as we've seen in recent times with the horrific abductions and murders of innocent, vulnerable women, that violence and aggression towards women is a very real issue.
What is all this around this violence? I mean, is there research behind why it all happens?
I imagine that there's a great deal of research. I don't have my fingers on it at the moment. But if you think about it, we live in a very much a male-dominated society. We have for many, many generations. I think women, as much as the status of women has progressed over the last few generations, I think women are probably still vulnerable to dominance, are in some communities still considered the property of men. And I think all of that works towards positioning women in a vulnerable situation.
Now, how do we get behind this cause, 1 Billion Rising?
Well, what you do is our goal is to bring thousands of people, men and women, together in Fed Square next year on February 14th. Our goal is to have musicians and DJs and poets and representatives from the women's sector speaking and performing at Fed Square. The event's going to run from approximately 5 o'clock. And we're asking people to gather after work in their thousands to come and be visible and protest and dance their reaction to violence against women. So what you can do, you can like our Facebook page. So our Facebook page is 1 Billion Rising Melbourne, and you can like that page and join the event. You can also go to 1billionrising.org, which is the official site for it. And then from there, you can look for an event in Melbourne, and the link will take you through to our event, and you can RSVP. You can also contact me at 1billionrisingmelbourne@gmail.com to be in touch with regards to contributing time, talent, or funds.
Fantastic. Tamar Spats there talking about 1 Billion Rising, a great community initiative. Tamar, thank you for joining us on today's edition of Mind Food.
Not a problem. It was a pleasure.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
And now on Mind Food Radio, off to another wonderful place, the Mornington Peninsula, Michael.
And do you know what? About 2 weeks ago, I went there and I spent a weekend driving around going to all these beautiful wineries.
It like?
Do you know, it actually reminded me a lot of New Zealand.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the country is quite
undulating
and rolling hills. It runs right down into the ocean, which is beautiful.
Okay.
And it really is the most spectacular place.
Yeah.
It's everyone is very friendly. They're always pleased to see you. But it's just great. You know, you kind of roll into, you know, different places.
Sure.
Lots of orchards as well as all the wineries.
Okay.
But in February, there is going to be a Pinot Noir celebration, which is absolutely extraordinary. They do it every 2 years. And on the show today, we've got our guest, who's a master of wine, actually, Kate McIntyre. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
So tell us about a little bit more about this Pinot Noir celebration in February.
Well, it's a big event that we run every 2 years down on the Moisa Peninsula, and we run it at the Cape Shank RACV Club. It's a big Pinot Fest. We just sit around tasting Pinot for 2 days. It's wonderful. It's very geeky, and we get to taste a lot of wonderful, wonderful Pinot, both from the Mornington Peninsula, from other Pinot-producing regions in Australia, and we always have some very exciting international guests.
Kate, well, what do you like about Pinot?
Well, what's not to like about good Pinot? Pinot is really, it's a beautifully versatile grape variety. It's a red variety. It can be light and pale red and red-fruited, or it can be really dark and tannic and structured and have cherry fruit and dark Asian spices. It's incredibly food-friendly. It has, but the most wonderful thing about good Pinot is the texture. It has this beautiful silky texture to it, and it's just very easy to drink.
So in terms of the region itself, is that what it's famed for?
Yeah, the Mornington Peninsula, really, we hang our hat on our Pinot Noirs. We think it's a very special place to grow Pinot. Pinot can be a very difficult grape variety to grow. It's very fussy about where it's planted and how it's made, and the Mornington Peninsula just seems to be one of those very special places. It's cool climate, it's maritime. We get a nice long slow ripening period, so it builds up beautiful complexity of flavour, and yeah, I think we make some of the best Pinot Noir in Australia down here on the Mornington Peninsula.
You definitely do. I had the beautiful Coorong, is it, out at Phillip Estate. That was really gorgeous, that.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing in Mornington Peninsula is the quality of the restaurants as well and these wineries. It's just extraordinary.
We're very spoiled. We're really spoiled with food and wine down here. I mean, I think it kind of reflects the fact that the people down here who run the wineries also love food and love the way that food and wine go together. So, you know, great food and great wine is terrific, and we're all very passionate about it. And we have a plethora of choices as far as places to eat and drink.
These restaurants didn't try to be a city restaurant, you know.
Yeah.
But none of them, you know, were wannabe city restaurants. They were really proud of where they came from. All the produce was local.
That's,
you know,
right.
Obviously the wine is just absolutely extraordinary. Mm. So it really is just the most fantastic place to go and visit. And a lot of Melburnians, of course, have been going for weekends, haven't they? It's always been kind of the thing to do.
Well, it's only an hour's drive from Melbourne, so it's a really manageable thing to do for a day. But why would you come down for a day when you can come down for a weekend? It's a beautiful place to stay.
Now, if any of our listeners wanted to go to the Pinot Noir celebration in February, how do they get the information or tickets for that?
The best thing for them to do would be to get onto their computers and have a look at the Mornington Peninsula Vineyards Association website, which is just www.mpva.com.au. And then you just follow the prompts to events and Mornington Peninsula International Pinot Celebration. And if they have a look at that and that sounds a bit too serious for them, we have a more relaxed Pinot walk-around tasting happening on a Sunday, which is a really nice way to just taste a lot of local wines in one spot.
Well, Kate, thank you very much for joining us on today's program.
For more details, just go to mindfood.com. You can read my story, and we've also got a gallery of images and stuff of my trip to the Mornington Peninsula.
Fantastic.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Born in Auckland, this guy, well, Matthew Allen, is an emerging Sydney-based painter here, and he completed a Master's of Visual Arts degree in 2006. He joins us on today's program. How are you, Michael? You're looking very,
I'm very good.
Looking very bemused there.
But I always think it's always hard to interview an artist on the radio because unless you've got the artwork in front of you,
Michael was just
Matthew?
Pulling in a piece of your art. Actually.
I was. Yeah. I've got it here online. And look, you could be the next Mark Rothko. Who knows? We could be talking to the next big thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I could just start charging $75 mil for a painting.
But do you know what I'm saying there? Because art is such a visual thing. In terms of radio, sometimes it's very hard.
Theatre of the mind, Michael. Can you paint a picture on the radio?
Well, also, Matthew's pieces
are very...
Well, how would you describe Matthew? You're the artist.
They're subtle gradations, tonal paintings, really. So the basic one is just two colours that kind of shift into each other.
That's right. Now, and how do you do them? Is it just, is it with a roller or a brush?
No, it's with a brush, and it's with oil paint that's being thinned down until it's basically like the consistency of water. And I will paint the entire canvas, and then overnight it flows down and kind of dries as it's flowing. And that's how I create the shifts in tone.
Now, how long have you been working on this type of artwork?
This process, probably since 2004.
Oh, wow. For quite a while.
It's a very dedicated kind of process, yeah.
And how long did it take to perfect?
I don't think it's perfected yet.
Oh, really? It's a work in progress, is it?
Still going. Yeah, yeah. It's always finding different ways of working with it or changing. There's about five things I mix into the medium.
Right.
So I play with ratios to try and, you know, get different effects.
So it's a little bit like KFC. There's a secret ingredient.
Five secret herbs and spices, not 11.
Can you describe for the listener, though, like in terms of your art? I mean, there are artists who paint, you know, portraits and things like that. Your art is very the opposite to that.
It is.
What do you say to people when they look at your art sometimes and they think, oh, that's interesting?
Yeah.
You know, like people would think they could do it themselves. That's what I'm trying to say.
Definitely. I've had people ask me when I'm going to finish the paintings as they're up in the gallery on the wall.
How does that make you feel as an artist?
I'm a pretty easygoing guy. I know that there are people that get it, and I know that there are people that give it the five-second glance.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And is that because they just don't understand it, or they just it doesn't catch their attention?
It's interesting with such simple work that it can be kind of difficult in a way, like, you can say, okay, there's nothing there, or you can say, yes, there's very subtle things going on within the structure of the painting that maybe you have to look at it for a while to see it.
And so, where does most of your art go? I can imagine it in beautiful beach houses and stuff like that.
I think at the moment it is mainly for houses. That's pretty much it, which is good. I think they're objects to be lived with.
So when you're creating your art, do you think where it will end up? Do you have a vision like this is going to be for corporates or this is going to be for people at home?
No, not really.
For everybody.
It's more just the concerns of what's going on the painting itself rather than where it might end up.
In terms of the colour palette, you know, do you find the process, you almost become a colourist and applying and, you know, the range of colours that in the end you're never quite 100% sure what you're going to get, or is that...
Definitely.
Yeah,
that's
what the process is about.
It is, and it's also interesting. Sometimes I go in with a very set idea of what colour relationship I want, and it won't happen, and I will consider the work a failure, but I've had instances where I've left the painting for a couple of months, you know, thinking I was going to throw it out, and have come in to the studio and really liked it, and you just have to kind of let go of your original intention because it's become something else which is still valid.
Matthew, thanks for joining us today and shedding some light on your art. Yeah,
I've got to tell you, you know, until I sort of started talking to you and then I've gone online and look, your art looks amazing. So well done.
Thank you, mate. Thanks. Pleasure.
Okay.
Now, for more details, you can jump onto mindfood.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
We always love this time of the program. Well, Therese Mudgway always has something interesting for us.
Well, do you remember last week?
I was strangling myself last week.
You didn't even find your collarbone.
No, I couldn't.
Yeah, and you've still got that mark.
I don't know what she's got in store for us today.
Welcome to the show, Therese.
Thank you, guys.
Today we're going to talk about being a victim of your circumstance or master of your experience.
Yeah.
So is that just sort of turning any situation around?
Well, it is, but it's a little bit more than that because it's very easy to say, well, let's turn a situation around. And probably right now being coming into Christmas, it's a really good time to talk about this because we are constantly bombarded with advertising about what you should or shouldn't have, what you should or shouldn't get in order to be happy in life. You know, we're in a time in a world of consumerism.
Yeah, I know.
But is it about sort of taking responsibility, I guess, for who you are and how you want to be?
A little bit even more than that, Mike.
Yeah.
Because if you look at life and what we're conditioned into from a very, very young age is a model that goes along the lines of when you have X, then you will do Y.
Oh, yeah.
And then you'll be...
happy.
Correct.
Yeah.
Or content, or beautiful, or desired, or intelligent, or successful. Think about TV commercials, right? Shampoo, classic one. When you have the shampoo, what you will do is you will wash your hair under a waterfall in the Garden of Eden with birds and butterflies, and who you will be as a goddess.
Yeah.
For example, right?
Mm.
Now, I've washed my hair with said shampoo on a Saturday morning after a big Friday night, and I can tell you there was no goddess getting out of my shower.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But we do, even though we know that doesn't work, we do buy into it on some level. And there's a level of emotional manipulation in there. And part of it is because we're constantly conditioned in this world, when you have stuff, then that will lead to happiness.
And then they get it, and then they're not happy, so then they try and get something else.
Correct.
And, yeah.
So it's a conditioning. Now, the big question is, gentlemen, are you your thoughts and feelings?
I try to be.
Have you ever been in a social event or in social situation where there's some very obnoxious, loud, annoying pillock in the corner somewhere?
Yeah.
And you have felt and you have thought about going up and telling them to shut up or slapping them around the head and making them shut up?
Yep.
Have you felt it, thought it, but did you do it?
No.
So no, you don't. Now, part of that is social conditioning, all those sorts of things, but consider if we were or we are our thoughts and feelings, then we wouldn't have any control over doing that.
Yeah.
You may feel like doing it, you may think about doing it, but you don't.
Yeah.
So consider you are not your thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
We are fundamentally human what?
Beings.
Beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
So given we're human beings, guess what the one thing that we have control over?
Our being?
Yeah, who and how we be. Moment by moment, given every situation. So in the example that I gave you, you could be angry and furious and a reaction to that person that's annoying you, or you can be graceful, or you can be forgiving, or you can be compassionate, or you can be silent, however you want to be. And that's the one thing that you get to say how you handle that.
Therese, it's so in-depth. We need to have her own program developed here. Michael's pulling out a deck chair. And I think, you know, all those points that you raise are really, really good. And, of course, for more details, you can jump onto mindfood.com.
Well, this is a great My Story. At his brother's wedding in 2002, 30-year-old Josh Kench sat with a cigarette in one hand and a beer in the other, and announced that he was going to do the Coast to Coast. And that is a giant big run and cycling thing. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Yeah, g'day.
Now, you've actually gone on. Not only have you done that, you've become an endurance cyclist. Is that right? Or an ultra-endurance cyclist?
Yep, that's correct, yep.
Now, during the day, you're a plumber, but at night and weekends, you're out on the road, you know, cycling and very long distances. How did you get into that? You know, because that's very different than just sort of going for a quick
stroll.
Yeah.
after doing the coast to coast, I figured out, you know, I didn't really enjoy running that much. Couldn't swim, so the kayak was out. So, I really enjoyed the biking side of it. And also, I like the long sort of endurance side of it, so it made sense that I go and start doing some long bike racing instead.
Now, you've been to some pretty extraordinary places, haven't you, across the globe?
I guess my first big race overseas was the Paris-Brest-Paris in France. It's sort of an Audax-style ride, sort of slash race. Obviously, starts in Paris, goes out to the coast, to Brest, and then back again. It's like 1,200 k's. So that was sort of my first overseas adventure on the push bike. And then.
And how long would have that taken you?
Oh, just over 60 hours.
Wow.
So, where do you sleep?
On the bike? Michael and I, if we were riding, I'm telling you, Michael and I would stop talking at some point, and then the bikes would just go into a free fall.
That would take me 60 days.
Or we'd be walking along, pushing our bikes. Yeah.
I know, I'd find someone.
And Michael would be going, can someone just hold my laptop so I can send another email?
I know, that is actually quite true. Sorry, Josh. So, have you changed your diet a lot? Because, you know, cyclists look so skinny. Like, there's not an inch of fat on them. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm your regular looking cyclist, but no, I probably just eat more than what I used to now, really.
And burn it off.
Yeah.
You know, as you're cycling along in these extraordinary places where you go to, do you ever kind of look around at all the landscape, or are you so focused on getting there? Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, some of the places you've been to sound absolutely beautiful, but do you actually get time to kind of look around and enjoy it?
Well, it's the difference between like the endurance cycling and the short cycling, where you're in a big peloton, I guess.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're out there by yourself, you know, you can, you're not just looking at someone's rear end the whole time. You can actually look around. So if I'm not sort of falling asleep, I'm having a pretty good look around, or if it's not dark.
So actually, that's the thing. If you are starting to feel like you're falling asleep or it's dark, what do you do in those circumstances?
You put on your night goggles.
Yeah.
Have lights on the front of your bike, you know, you just sort of, or support vehicle behind you with their lights on. But no, I just have lights on my bike, but they're bright enough to sort of see where I'm going most of the time.
I imagine you do a lot of thinking.
Yeah. Do you?
Yeah, well, I try not to, but yeah.
That shoots that theory down.
What do you mean you try not to? What do you mean you don't try and think?
I don't really want to think about getting to the finish or anything like that.
No.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Especially sort of early. So, I guess your mind just sort of wanders off.
But as fatigue is starting to creep into your body, you know, because you've been doing it for, say, I don't know, 59 hours, and you know you've got another 10 or so to go, how do you stay on that bike? Because my little legs would turn into jelly.
I've sort of found out over the years that you can actually sort of, you can get to that jelly stage, and then you can sort of go past it again and just keep on going.
So mentally, what do you do?
Oh, I just tell myself to keep on pedaling. Because at the end of the day, you're not going to get there if you stop pedaling. So
yeah. Hey, Josh, thanks for joining us
today.
Thank
you very much, Josh. That was great. Yeah.
Around Australia, I can see it now. People are pulling their bikes out of the garage and blowing off the dust.
Exactly. They're racing.
Where's the pump for the tyres? And they'll be hitting the roads.
No, good on you. That's an extraordinary thing. Well, that was Josh Queens. For more details, go to mindfood.com.
Mindfood Radio. Smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
On Mind Food Radio, Care Australia's been around a long time, and we've decided to get Amelia Poxon on the radio with us today, Michael. Care Australia, of course, does some great things out there. How are you, Amelia?
I'm well, thank you.
Tell us about what you're doing with your campaign in 2013.
Thanks. We're really excited about 2013. A major initiative for us will be our Walk in Her Shoes Challenge, which we're asking Australians to walk 10,000 steps a day for 1 week, from the 18th to the 24th of March. And to raise money to help lift women and girls out of poverty.
Can you give us a bit of background into what CARE is all about?
CARE Australia actually celebrated our 25th anniversary this year. We're an international aid organisation, so fighting poverty overseas, and we have a special focus on working with women and girls to help whole communities overcome poverty.
Walking in Your Shoes is not a new initiative. What makes 2013 a bit different?
Well, 2013 is going to be bigger and better than any other Walk in Her Shoes we've had before. It's only December now, but we're certainly ramping up, and everyone in the office here is really excited about making this campaign bigger than we've ever had in the past. So we're hoping to have over 6,000 participants joining us and walking 10,000 steps every day from the 18th to the 24th of March. And we're also excited to welcome back our major ambassador, Chrissy Swan, who'll be helping us spread the word. And we're also excited to have a brand new website which will help participants connect with other walkers and also connect with the communities they're helping overseas.
And what are some of the projects that, you know, the money that gets raised goes to?
So the money that gets raised goes to support CARE's work, helping some of the poorest communities in the world. So it goes towards projects like one I visited in Ethiopia last year, where CARE was supporting a water users group to come together and bring clean water to their community for the first time. But one of the amazing benefits of this group is that it's not only providing a clean water source, but it's also breaking down gender inequalities that have existed within the community for years. So we're encouraging women to participate and take on a leadership role, and also to gain an education and new skills.
Yeah, because you help over 191 projects a year, 22 countries, and you reach more than 5.4 million people. So the reliance on people giving generously to help your cause is a big part of the business, hey?
That's right. And we're so grateful that the Australian public are incredibly generous and supportive of CARE's work. And we're really hopeful and excited that through Walk In Her Shoes we'll be able to help even more people overcome poverty.
Any listeners today, you know, listening to this, what can they do to help?
It's really easy to sign up to Walk In Her Shoes. All you need to do to register is go online, walkinhershoes.org.au, and you can register there, set up your online fundraising page, and CARE will post out your very own pedometer in the mail, and that will help you to track your 10,000 steps. And you can track your donations online as well.
Now, how many people do you think are going to get involved this time round?
Well, we were really thrilled with our results this year. We had 2,800 Australians walking the streets for Walk In Her Shoes. But we're setting our sights pretty high next year. We want to get 6,000 people on board to help to raise money for CARE's work and raise awareness.
Okay, so to get behind it, what's the website?
The website, walkinhershoes.org.au.
And on there you can make your donation and all that type of thing as well, hey?
That's right. It's really easy to set up your online fundraising page, and there are tools there that can help you reach out to your networks and ask them to sponsor you.
It's a great thing to do with your friends and a great way to get out and get fit and do all those things, and you know, and you're doing a good cause at the same time and helping people in other parts of the world. So you do a great job.
Yeah, absolutely. 10,000 steps might sound a little bit daunting, but it's around 6 to 8 kilometres, depending on how long your legs are. And we find that it's about 1 hour of extra walking for people each day. So
that's
a little
fine.
Bit of a challenge.
Thank you very much, Amelia Poxon there from CARE Australia. Of course, for more details, you can jump onto mindfood.com.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Welcome back to Mind Food Radio. Well, here's a man who is not too, well, afraid to be on the radio. Angus, you regularly do radio on ABC Radio, but what's one of the common questions you get asked around this time of year in terms of watering?
Yes, it's how to actually keep the water up during this holiday period when people are partying and on holidays and it's the hottest time of the year. So it's traditionally a time when people come back to the garden and whoops, if it's been a dry period.
Yeah. So some of the tips that we need to be aware of for summer, I mean, some places have water restrictions.
Yes. Look, the first thing is acclimatising plants to less water. So often when people buy a plant from a nursery, it's been watered every day to really get it looking in its prime, and then they bring it home, plant it, and if it then just doesn't get watered regularly for the first month or two, often they'll just turn up their toes and die because they're used to getting watered every day.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the first step, is hardening the plants off gradually if you've planted them. The second thing is, if you do have a dry period going on, then plants, you just need to watch them, and if they start to wilt and look a bit tired, then they're crying out for a bit of extra water. And there's a couple of things I really recommend through summer. Obviously, mulching to try and keep water in the soil.
Sure.
But to get sort of supplementary water in there, there's a couple of things you can do. First thing is just get a water bottle, you know, an old drink bottle, and cut the bottom off it and bury that beside the plant. And then you can give it a litre of water that gradually soaks in, or however big the bottle is.
Yep.
It's a matter of actually getting the water down to the root system too. Sometimes you'll see water actually not penetrating very well. It just balls and sits on the surface.
Yeah.
And runs off. So creating a dish around your plant, a little hollow where water can just stay there and gradually soak in. Or there are also wetting agents that you can apply to the soil to help the water soak in. They're a bit like, they have a detergent-like action. But you do need a horticultural wetting agent.
What about watering plants? Is there any correct time, morning, afternoon, middle of the day? What's the best time?
Yes, look, you definitely, I think, is a big advantage in watering at the beginning of the day, before the heat of the day sets in and the plants are starting to wilt. So
yep.
You can get them kind of charged up before the heat really sets in. And getting the water down deeply too, I think, is one of the key issues, because often you water and then find, if you dig down, that the water's only gone down a centimetre or so, and the actual roots that are down deeper aren't getting any water at all. And with pot plants, what I really recommend highly is, especially if the pot is really dry, is to just immerse the whole pot in a bucket of water, and you'll see all those bubbles of air come up, and it's really difficult sometimes if a pot has dried out to get it properly watered again.
So thanks for your advice on watering. I might go throw myself in the pool.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Angus. Enjoy. Have a nice Christmas, by the way, too.
You too, Ben.
Well, as we draw to the end of the year, it's not far away now, only a matter of minutes, days, time. What are you going to do in the new year? Do you do New Year's resolutions?
Oh, do you know what? I've given up on those. I think, you know, by the second or third, you're always feeling guilty because you've already fallen off the wagon.
Exactly.
I really think it's all about just empowering yourself and having a good, you know, write down whatever you really want to achieve.
Yeah, I love doing those storyboards.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
do they
ever
work?
I write them down, yeah, and then you cut out photos out of magazines, probably your magazine is good, and you put them on there and you visualise.
Oh, it sounds very Oprah.
Oh, it
doesn't it?
Well, look, Michael, thanks for a fantastic time. It's been a great year, and next year, another big year of Mind Food Radio.
It sure is.
And until then, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.